Welcome everyone. I think most people here have been to one of our seminars. Oh, hello. I don't really need to introduce him, but this week we have David Soud speaking on Octavio Paz, and there'll be time, perhaps 10 or 15 minutes, for questions once David has finished his talk.
Mm-hmm. And I certainly invite the questions. This is different from my other talks in that the others arose directly from my doctoral research, whereas this is just an area of personal interest that I'm slowly evolving into scholarly research. So it's a bit more of an exploratory talk, and yet I think it's very, very interesting. Now, Octavio Paz is, one of the giants of world literature and certainly of Latin American literature of the 20th century. He lived from 1914 to 1998. Won the Nobel Prize in 1990, was as prolific an essayist as he was a poet, and was arguably the most supremely cosmopolitan poet of the 20th century. His writings incorporated just a staggering range of influences, ranging from the Spanish Baroque to pre-Columbian cultures, to the symbolist and surrealist traditions, to, of course, Indic traditions, which is one of the things I'm going to address today. He lived all over the world in his youth, not just Mexico. He knew André Breton and the surrealists and all those guys in Paris when he lived there for a while. He served in the diplomatic corps in India twice, once very briefly in the early 50s when they first opened a diplomatic mission to the relatively young state of India, and then he served as Mexico's ambassador to India from 1962 to 1968 when he resigned in protest over the treatment of student demonstrators in the run-in to the Olympics. And it was certainly a grief, a major grief, for him to have to leave India in that way. He had become deeply immersed in Indian culture. In fact, his chief translator, Elliot Weinberger, has said, and I think it's probably true, that no other Western poet has been as immersed in India as Paz. Now, the first time he went to India, he found himself confronted with an other that challenged his basically his entire ontology, and so he the first poem that he wrote coming out of India, and I'll just read a brief chunk of it, was in a way his resistance. He described it actually as an act of resistance against what he called the metaphysical temptation of India. And just one passage from a poem called Mutra that explains or illustrates where he was internally at that point. It goes as follows. We are not. I do not want to be God. I do not want to grope in the dark. I will not return. I am a man, and man is man. He who leapt to the void, and since then nothing has sustained him but his own wing. The one who let go of his mother, the exiled, rootless, with neither heaven nor earth, a bridge, a bow, stretched over nothing, in himself unified, made whole, and nevertheless split from the moment of his birth, struggling against his shadow, always running behind himself, blundering, exhausted, without ever reaching himself, condemned from childhood, alembic of time, king of himself, son of his own works. So you can sort of hear him sounding a kind of defiantly individualistic and sort of, you know, to put it a bit reductively, Western note there, which is actually how he would frame it. But when he returned to India in 1962, he, as he later said, he had lots of time to study, and he did a lot of reading, he did a lot of studying, a lot of traveling, and really got to know a number of people who could teach him a great deal about Indic traditions of various kinds. He also met his wife there, and they had sort of one of these, you know, great sort of inspirational marriages in a lot of ways. His wife, the French artist Marie-José Tramini, became his muse. He actually called marrying her his second birth. And he found it an absolutely transformative experience living there. And one of the quotations is actually on the handout. And I think it's very pointed how he describes it. He says, "My education in India lasted for years and was not confined to books. Although it is far from complete and will remain forever rudimentary, it has marked me deeply. It has been a sentimental, artistic, and spiritual education. Its influence can be seen in my poems, my prose writings, and in my life itself." And I think, really, if you look at that passage, he's unmistakably suggesting that it is not just an intellectual sort of sojourn that he had in India. It was one in which he tried to gain real experiential understanding of those traditions, insofar as it was possible for him. And a number of books arose, and you have some of them listed on your handout from his Indian experience. Perhaps his most famous poem, actually, Sunstone, was written after his first visit. In a sense, he was already entering into that dialogue, already studying a bit, and preparing himself in some ways for the more thorough immersion that would happen from 1962 to 1968. And East Slope, which was published, and of course I'm translating all these into English, Ladera Este, but East Slope is essentially the Indic collection, published the year after he returned. And again, as I said, a prolific essayist, probably the most exhaustive study that came out, if you want to read it, is Conjunctions and Disjunctions, which was, as you can see, also written shortly after his return. The Monkey Grammarian, and much later, In Light of India, which has much more of the flavor of a memoir to it, and ranges over a broader stretch of topics. Now, he had a very pointed view of Indian civilization, a very distinct view, did Paz. He regarded Indian civilization as at best slumbering and at worst comatose. He felt that it had lost its vivifying energies and had lost them some time ago, actually. And for him, those energies are essentially dialectical. And that's a huge point that will be a part of his engagement with Tantra. But he says at one point, referring to what he calls Hindu civilization, he says that Hindu civilization is the theater of a dialogue between one and zero, being and emptiness, yes and no. And under that rubric, he frames sort of dialogues between Buddhism and Hinduism. Fullness of being, which he associates with Hinduism, emptiness of being that he associates with Buddhism. And he knows all this is reductive and that these are very paradoxical categories, but he goes ahead and plays with them. Samkhya Vedanta, Vedanta Tantra, all sorts of, sort of the renunciate versus the affirmative and that sort of thing. And he says, it is not by chance, at one point he says, that India discovered zero. Mm-hmm. And yet that fascination with being and non-being, that the flip side of discovering zero, he feels in Indian culture, is a fascination and love for objects that function as talismans, utensils, highly ritualized external forms of worship, etc. So that dialectic gets played out on every level. But he also offers lots of sort of capsule histories of India. And I selected one that I'll read to you that I think conveys his sense of broad strokes and consciously reductive sense of the history of India. He writes, "In India, Hinduism and Buddhism were the protagonists of a dialogue. This dialogue was Indian civilization. The fact that it is now ended helps explain the prostration of this civilization for over 8 centuries and its inability to renew itself and change. The dialogue degenerated into the monologue of Hinduism, a monologue that soon assumed the form of repetition and mannerism until finally ossification set in. Islam, appearing just as Buddhism disappears in India, failed to take its place. The opposition between Hinduism and Buddhism is a contradiction within one and the same system, whereas that between Islamism and Hinduism is the confrontation of two different and incompatible systems. Something occurred later in the case of Christianity, and today is occurring with the ideologies linked to this religion, democracy, socialism, etc. So you can see he's quite sweeping in his sort of large-scale judgments, but they do sort of have to be factored in to our understanding of how his work addresses Indic traditions. But he's, you know, basically, again and again in his prose about India, you encounter metaphors of ossification, petrification, sclerosis, etc., etc. Okay? And that sense of ossification recalls Blake, recalls Yeats, recalls any number of systems in which conflict is vitalizing and the lack of conflict becomes stultifying and ultimately deadening. And so the play of contraries is actually central to what Paz brings to his understanding of Tantra. For him, all human consciousness is governed by binary oppositions. Obviously, 1-0 being, you know, the sort of primary binary. But, of course, also one of those oppositions is between the many and the one, between, you know, multiplicity and unity, and the desire to return to a primordial unity. And this is really stuff that he, you know, he sort of drags a net through all sorts of things in sort of furnishing his mind. And you see, you hear all these echoes, particularly in his writings about India, of like Levi Strauss and Eliade and, you know, so forth. But for him, in binary oppositions, the question is, what's the healthy relationship? And for him, the ideal relationship, which is the right measure of affinity versus opposition, involves a dynamic tension. And as he puts it, too much opposition cancels out one of the terms. Too much affinity also destroys it. The predominance of one of the terms disturbs the balance. Absolute equality between the two terms produces neutralization and, as a consequence, immobility. The ideal relationship demands a certain slight disequilibrium of forces and a relative autonomy of each term with respect to the other. The essential thing is for the relationship not to be a tranquil one. The dialogue between oscillation and immobility is what gives a culture life and life form. Okay, that, you know, just thinking back to my previous talk, that could easily have just been lifted right out of A Vision by Yeats. But in India, he sees a special case of the play of opposition, because he refers also to the Indian fondness for suppressing contraries without destroying them, that it has an unparalleled capacity for synthesis and fusion and absorption. Referring to Indian temples, he was very much a student of Indian art and architecture. And he says, in Indian temples, life does not fight death, it absorbs it. You know? But the sort of governing binary, and this is where he starts to develop his interest in tantric traditions, is between the signs, as he calls them, of body and non-body. Okay, and this central dualism is, you know, as he says, the spirit of all men in all times is the theater of the dialogue between the sign body and the sign non-body. This dialogue is man. So you have the dialogue that is India kind of writ small here, or, you know, you can flip it. He sees this actually as being central to this sort of dialectic, as being central within traditions and also between sort of East and West. He makes a comparison between Indic religions, in this case particularly Buddhism, and Christianity, which is actually kind of fascinating and revealing. He says, a religion that denies the reality of the body exalts it in its most striking form, eroticism. A religion that has made incarnation its central dogma spiritualizes and transfigures the flesh. So that within each tradition, you see the tension played out between the body and the non-body. And when looking at the figures on the Buddhist temple at Karli, he said, seeing those naked couples, sensual without cruelty, I understood the meaning of the word benevolence. Those giant smiles are the incarnations of the syllable yes, an enormous and carnal acceptance of life, a yes as huge as the waves in the mountains, and yet a great paradox. These sculptures guard a temple to emptiness, an altar to zero, a sanctuary of the no. And so where this leads him is to a particular interest in Tantra, with its a sort of treatment of the body and the non-body, and particularly its affirmation of the body. Now, while he recognizes and in some cases discusses the differences between Buddhist and, for lack of a better term, Hindu Tantra, he often discusses them as being essentially at parts of the same tradition, and even addresses the issue of, well, chicken and egg, which came first, who influenced whom a little bit. He occupies the same sort of interpretive space in some ways that André Padou does when Padou argues that Tantra arose partly as a reaction against the spirit of renunciation, as he says it, that settles in India with the Upanishads and early Buddhism. Though it is, of course, also partly rooted in the form. And actually, I could sort of point back to Tristan's last talk, where you can see in some of those you know, early rituals, you know, erotic and sexual elements that clearly were part of the tradition. And you know, it's all stuff that's sort of ongoing. At one point, Paas does actually say the history of Tantrism has not been written. He says that writing in 1974, but it's still true. I mean, a lot more has been done, and yet there's an epic task before the scholars seeking to do that. But he relates Tantra to Protestantism in the West as sort of mirror images of each other, as examples of an excessive disequilibrium between the signs body and non-body. In Protestantism, the repression of the body predominates. And in Tantrism, reintegration of the body dominates. One of the things that I find fascinating about Paas, that a sort of interesting omission, is that in all this talk about dialectic and dialogue, he never, to my knowledge, in his writings on Tantra, incorporates or seems to recognize that most of the Tantras are in fact dialogues within themselves, you know, between the deity and a consort or the sage or whatever. But so for him, Tantra is essentially the mirror image of asceticism. It's in a way, it's a classic, a reformulation of that classic distinction, you know, where the, oh, Vedanta is neti, and then, you know, Tantra is the mirror image of that. But in any case, he has a lovely, I had mentioned his treatment of Buddhist and Hindu tantric traditions. He has a beautiful formulation of that, actually, where he says, the dialogue between Buddhism and Hinduism is transformed in Tantrism into something like a love duet. Charmed by the same melody, the two protagonists take the words out of each other's mouth. Which is essentially a very poetic way of saying that they kind of blur just enough that I'm not going to distinguish between them too much. But for him, the fascinating thing about Tantra, obviously, is what we've been having for, is its potential to resolve or transcend binary oppositions, even as it seems to occupy a space that, as he says, creates a disequilibrium favoring the body over the non-body. The aim of Tantra, as he describes it, is to tear down the walls, to go beyond limits, to erase the differences between the horrible and the divine, the animal and the human, dead flesh and living bodies, to experience samarasa, the identical flavor of all substances. And it's here that we start to see an interesting application to poetry, because for him, poetry whether he was working out of a surrealist tradition, which he could now then sort of graft on to Tantra a little bit, this idea of exploding or breaking down boundaries or achieving a kind of higher transcendence. What goes with that also is the sense that the constricted or the limited self with which we navigate the phenomenal universe is an unstable thing, an unstable, unreliable, and ultimately unreal thing. And in one of his poems from East Slope, Vrindavan, he actually incorporates both Buddhist and Hindu elements here. He says, reads as follows: "Gone, gone, saint, clown, saint, beggar, king, damned. It is the same, always the same, within the same. It is always to be closed within oneself, closed up in the same, closed up in oneself, rotted idol." Okay? And the idea of smashing that idol is a central theme, one way or another. He actually goes on to say, "I am a history, a memory inventing itself." So that the self, the limited self, the indexical self, however you want to frame it, is essentially a kind of narrative and an unstable one. And that's something that he's dealt with even earlier. If we go back to Sunstone in 1957, a poem that actually is circular, in the same sort of way as Finnegan's Wake. He actually has a passage of one of many, I'll say. "Was it I making plans for the summer and for all the summers on Christopher Street 10 years ago with Phyllis, who had two dimples in her cheeks where sparrows came to drink the light? On the Reforma, did Carmen say to me, 'The air's so crisp here, it's always October'? Or was she speaking to another I've forgotten? Or did I invent it and no one said it?" Okay, that sense of just this radical instability and the fact that underneath it there must be some unchanging subject that he must some way or another access is part of what drives him toward Tantra. And part of the reason he's attracted by Tantra is he does not want to access that unchanging subject by a process of negation under the sign of the non-body. So he actually ends up preferring the disequilibrium that tends toward the sign of the body. As he says, "Tantrism preaches a total experience, both carnal and spiritual, which must be felt and lived concretely in the ritual." Now, of course, for him, then, that pure subjectivity, that sort of tantrically inflected absolute, is very similar to what you would expect from what Gavin has called the ecstatic tantra, the non-dual tantra of Kashmir, Abhinavagupta and his offspring, to, as Alexis Sanderson frames it, to just say that all phenomena are nothing but the spontaneous self-projection of an all-encompassing divine consciousness, so that the substance of the universe and its efficient cause are one and the same. And in this sense, you see, for instance, the governing metaphor of this circular poem, in some ways, Sunstone, what it opens and closes with is the image of a fountain, which he describes as a single presence in a surge of waves, closed on itself. So there are the waves, obviously, and then there is, what the kind of stillness beneath, and which is somehow inseparable from the waves. And he defines his absolute at one point in tantric sense by saying the following: "The absolute, represented by Shiva, is the subject absorbed in the dream of its infinite solipsism. The appearance of Shakti is the birth of the object. Nature, the concrete world, which rouses the subject from its lethargy." And that's something that, is very sort of one of those central sort of cosmological principles of a number of sort of tantric texts, right? And he describes God in Sunstone in very specific terms when he says the world strips off its masks, and at its heart, a transparent shimmer that we call God, nameless being who studies himself in the void, faceless being emerged from himself, son of suns, plenitude of presences and names. So you see that principle sort of inscribed into the poetry there. And in Vrindavan, a sort of, again, tantrically inflected cosmology where he describes fever of forms, fever of time, ecstatic in its combinations, the whole universe a peacock's tail, myriads of eyes, other eyes reflecting, modulations, reverberations of a single eye, a solitary sun hidden behind its cloth of transparencies, its tide of marbles. So, you get that sense. Actually, in one other poem from East Slope, it's actually the poem East Slope, that's what it is. He describes visiting Elephanta, and he says, throne of bone, throne of noon, that island on its lion-colored cliffs I saw for an instant true life. It had the face of death, the same face dissolved in the same sparkling sea. So you get these sort of aquatic metaphors that are really useful for capturing that kind of unity underlying apparent multiplicity. Obviously you could take that in a sort of renunciate direction, or you could take it in a different direction. I mean, that idea of unity underlying multiplicity can be spun lots of different ways. Where he finds it most compelling is when, for him, tantrism actually achieves two things: a kind of transgression of limits and erotic union. So a good deal of his poetry picks up on those aspects, and of course, you know, we know about the more transgressive aspects of Tantra. And Paas freely says, having read some of these tantric texts, I can tell you, it would be very nice to whitewash it, more or less, he says, but some of these ritual things, if we are to take them literally, are criminal. You know, he uses the word criminal. And yet, he understands how the very category of criminal ceases to have meaning at a certain extremity of human experience. And he does mention the principle of sexual rituals involving the yoginis. And that whole issue of the eventual domestication, as Alexis Anderson has called it, of some of those more transgressive rituals involving, you know, substances of power and sexual emissions and so forth into things that were more mainstream. But once again, blurring Hindu and Buddhist traditions, he seizes on this as something as a kind of Indic analog to the Western poetic tradition of regarding sexual union, and particularly sexual climax, as a glimpse of transcendence. You know, that's the sort of thing that litters Western poetry. And if nothing else, people ought to be familiar with all the punning about death that goes on in a good deal of Renaissance poetry, whether it's steeped, you know, in this notion that every orgasm takes a day off your life, or probably more likely in that notion of le petit mort, that sense that at the moment of sexual climax you really don't know who you are. You kind of experience a kind of dissolution that anticipates death, but in an ecstatic way. And in finding this tradition within the sort of tantric tradition, he gets fascinated with it. At one point he says, copulation atop ashes, destruction of the opposition between life and death, the dissolution of both. Copulation is the real and genuine union of samsara and nirvana, identity between existence and emptiness, thought and non-thought, maituna, two in one, The lotus and the lightning bolt, the vulva and the phallus, the vowels and the consonants, the right side of the body and the left, the world above and the world below. And the eroticism of that, the sort of spiritual eroticism of that, begins to really get asserted in one particular poem, The Wind from All Compass Points in East Slope. He actually deals with it in fairly explicit terms. And one passage runs, "If water is fire, flame dazzled, in the center of the spherical hour, a sorrel filly, a marching battalion of sparks, a real girl among wraith-like houses and people, presence, a fountain of reality. I looked out through my own unrealities. I took her hand. Together we crossed the four quadrants, the three times, floating tribes of reflections, and we returned to the day of beginning." He later refers to, obviously, an echo of sort of the lingam and the yoni, "scarlet stain upon the obdurate stone." And even more explicitly, he goes on to say, "Down there in the cleft, desire covers you with its two black wings. Your eyes flash open and close, phosphorescent animals. Down there, the hot canyon, a wave that stretches and breaks your legs apart, the plunging whiteness, the foam of our bodies, abandoned." Okay, with a wonderful double meaning on abandoned there. You know, that the bodies, you know, they're abandoned to passion, but they're also abandoned in a kind of transcendent union. And ultimately, in the same poem, he explicitly links the two lovers to Shiva and Parvati. He uses the same image of lingam and yoni in another poem, De Udaipur, and incorporates some of the more transgressive aspects of that eroticism in that poem when he describes more of that sort of apocalyptic imagery that you sometimes, you know, see in Tantra. "A small goat skips in Kali's court. Gods, men, and beasts eat from the same plate. Over the pale god, the black goddess dances, decapitated. Heat, the hour split open, and those mangoes rotten. Your face, the lake, smooth, without thoughts." This little sort of yogic twist at the end there. In one poem, and I'll just show it to you very briefly, called Altar, I mean, you basically got a kind of lingam and yoni thing going on the page there, you know, the concrete poem. For him, there's also clearly, you know, when he looks at this kind of erotic fusion, this synthesis, this transcendence of the binary opposition, there's a Jungian component to it. There's all sorts of structuralist stuff going on, and he sees it as not so much at this point body and non-body. As once the body, the sign of the body is affirmed, then the dialectic that gets played out is that between the masculine and the feminine. And he says tantrism takes as its point of departure the idea that in each man there is something feminine and in each woman something masculine. Instead of repressing and separating the feminine in man and the masculine in woman, tantrism seeks to reconcile the two elements. And he uses, and this is the sort of later, sort of sublimated notion of sexualized ritual in the tantric traditions. He says, during coitus, the couple tries to fuse the masculine and feminine elements to transcend the duality. The sexual act is a homologue of meditation, and both are homologues of reality. Tantrism knows nothing of what we call love. Its eroticism is sacramental. And that's clearly the more domesticated version of the spiritual efficaciousness, so to speak, of sexual union. And that's also something that he can seize on from the Western tradition, this kind of sacramentalized sense of sex, mainly from the Spanish Baroque. You see it in Sunstone, for instance, where he describes a woman's breasts as two churches where blood performs its own parallel rites. In any case, ultimately, what sexual union becomes for Paz is what he calls our share of paradise. It becomes, for him, in a sense that fuses that Western tradition with a sort of tantric, late tantric kind of sublimated sense of, as I said, spiritual efficaciousness. It becomes our best shot, our only shot, so to speak, in this life within these bodies as embodied beings, our only taste of the bliss of absolute being. He describes Shiva and Parvati at one point. He says, the divine couple are the image of a happiness that our mortal condition grants us only for a moment before it vanishes. A vision of happiness that is both terrestrial and unreachable. And one of the more memorable passages in Sunstone anticipates this. It involves a couple making love during the Spanish Civil War, is actually when this is happening. He says, the two took off their clothes and made love to protect our share of all that's eternal, to defend our ration of paradise and time, to touch our roots, to rescue ourselves, to rescue the inheritance stolen from us by the thieves of life centuries ago. The two took off their clothes and kissed. Because two bodies, naked and entwined, leap over time, they are invulnerable. Nothing can touch them. They return to the source. There is no you, no I, no tomorrow, no yesterday, no names. The truth of two in a single body, a single soul. Oh, total being. You can see exactly inscribed into the poetry there what he does in a limited way with what he's discovered or what he's found affirmed in his studies of tantric tradition. But it doesn't stop there for Paz, because the other thing, one of the chief concerns, he was a poet, and one of his chief concerns was language. And there really isn't time to talk about the preponderance of images in his Indic poems about, or images of syllables and sound vibrations and things like that, and that whole sort of the implications of that sort of cosmologically. But what I do find also interesting is his fascination with poetry as a kind of secular equivalent which can achieve a certain sacredness of the twilight language of tantric texts. He writes about tantra. Language occupies a central place in tantrism. It is a system of incarnated metaphors. Throughout these pages, referring to, I think this is In Light of India, I have referred to the play of echoes, correspondences, and equivalences of the ciphered language of the tantras. The ancient commentators referred to this erotico-metaphysical hermeticism, there's a formula for you, as the twilight language. Modern commentators, following Eliade, call it intentional language. But the specialists do not say, or else say it like somebody walking on red-hot coals, that this language is essentially poetic and obeys the same laws as poetic creation. Tantric metaphors are not only intended to hide the real meaning of the rites from intruders, they are also verbal manifestations of the universal analogy that is the basis of poetry. And in some ways, this recalls Abhinavagupta's axiom in Tantra Loka, as is the state of consciousness, so is the experience. And what Paz is essentially arguing that as is your state of consciousness, as is your ability to read these texts and also to read the cosmic text. And in that spirit, he compares the language of the tantras to the trobar clou of Provençal poetry, the old Occitan poetry. In order to decipher it, he says, it is not enough to know the key, but to make one's way into the forest of symbols, to be a symbol among symbols. Poetry and tantrism are alike in that they are both concrete, practical experiences. So that's in that sense, there's a physicality to it that I'll return to. But one of his things that he finds most fascinating about the language, and that he clearly tries to incorporate into his own poetry, is what he calls the principle of reversibility. He says, the language of the tantras is a poetic language, and its meanings are always multiple. It also has a quality that I would call reversibility. Each word can be converted into its contrary, and later, or simultaneously, turn into itself again. The basic premise of Tantrism is the abolition of contraries without suppressing them. This postulate brings on another, the mobility of the meanings, the continuous shifting of the signs and their meanings. By virtue of the law of reversibility, all the symbols are real and tangible. Concepts are bodies, and even nothingness has a flavor. Reality and symbol fuse, and as they fuse, they disappear. So obviously what's going on for him, there's not just this eroticism that attracts his interest. There's this sense that he is hitting on, to some degree, what lies at the heart of poetry. And this mobility of meanings, this reversibility, this mirroring, and ultimately this sort of fusion or transcendence of binary oppositions. And you see it even in Sunstone, where he sees, you know, the unity and bliss glimpsed in sexual union. It both affirms the physical universe and obliterates it. So that you get, within a few pages of each other, this passage. If two kiss, the world changes, desires take flesh, thoughts take flesh, wings sprout on the backs of the slave. The world is real and tangible. Wine is wine. Bread regains its savor. Water is water. And also, the world changes if two, dizzy and entwined, fall on the grass. The sky comes down, trees rise, space becomes nothing but light and silence. Open space for the eagle of the eye. So, you know, it both it affects an incarnation and a dissolution at the same time. So the body and the not body, you know, the non-body, are somehow they coexist in that moment. It's a both and. There is the principle of reversibility sort of inscribed into his poetry. And part of what goes with this is the sense of intextualizing the body, something that Gavin's certainly written quite a bit about. Paas says that this sort of inscribing and reading of the body that's characteristic of Tantra is, for him, a hallmark of primitive cultures. He says, primitive man also deciphers signs, he also reads, but his signs are a double of his body and the body of the world. The reading of primitive man is corporeal. And knowledge, in this case, is something that has to be inscribed in the body. And I think this is where I think, you know, he really reinforces this point again and again, and I think a really salutary way. He says, moksha is a gnosis and a praxis. First, it is a knowledge, not in the modern sense of knowing, which has generally been reduced to information about this or that, but in the more ancient sense of realizing the truth, that is, making it real and effective, living it and becoming one with it. Moksha is self-knowledge. And that sense of an interior kind of inscription of the knowledge through experience, he sees it everywhere in Indic traditions, and particularly Tantric ones. He talks about how the sign of the body covers the walls of Hindu temples. So there's this interplay. The body is converted into a textual sign, which is then inscribed on the temples, but then the text is also inscribed into the body. And in a memorable passage in the poem East Slope, written in Delhi, he actually refers to the city itself as a body that is inscribed with its traditions. Old Delhi, fetid Delhi, alleys and little squares and mosques, like a stabbed body, like a buried garden. For centuries it has rained dust. Your veil is a dust cloud. Your pillow a broken brick. On a fig leaf you eat the leftovers of your gods. Your temples are bordellos of the incurable. You are covered with ants. Abandoned lot. Ruined mausoleum. You are naked like a violated corpse. They stole your jewels and your burial clothes. You were covered with poems. Your whole body was writing. Remember. Recover the words. You are beautiful. You know how to talk and sing and dance. You can see that's arguably another capsule history of India there in verse form. When he actually says at one point, scripture is lived as a body that is an analog of the physical body. The body is read as scripture. You see those images of inscription. At one point in Sunstone, he refers to how this feminine in the poem, his lover, the goddess, something, armed with invisible razors, you write in red illegible characters on my skin. And in a poem titled Mituna, he actually regards sexual union as an act simultaneously of inscription and erasure, inscription on the body and erasure of the law. And he uses as the script the curls of his lover's cascading hair when she lets her hair down. Hair unpinned, tongue of whips, spoken tongues unfastened on your back, enlaced on your breasts, writing that writes you with spurred letters, denies you with branded signs, dress that undresses you, writing that dresses you in riddles, writing in which I am buried, hair unpinned, the great night swift over your body, jar of hot wine spilled on the tablets of the law. I mean, it's a very playful passage, but at the same time, you get that sense of the simultaneous inscription and erasure. And ultimately, also, the sense that he pulls out of Tantra of the body as a microcosm. As he describes, the real double of the universe. And this goes, again, back to things that scholars have talked about. Gavin, for instance, in the Tantric Body, talking about how to attain liberation is, broadly speaking, to trace a route back through the cosmos to its source, which is to trace a route through the body. And that this pathway involves the mapping of the body. And at one point, Paz actually quotes something on what he calls the religious geography of the body, with this from a poem of Sahara. Here in the body are the sacred rivers, Yamuna and Ganges. Here are the Pragya and Benares, the sun and the moon. In my wanderings, I have visited many sanctuaries, but none more holy than that of my body. And you see kind of him borrowing some of that, even in Sunstone, where he says of this feminine that he addresses throughout the poem, I travel your length like a river. I travel your body like a forest, like a mountain path that ends at a cliff. I travel along the edge of your thoughts, and my shadow falls from your white forehead. My shadow shatters, and I gather the pieces and go on with no body, groping my way. In this circular search for this pure subject that he embarks on in Sunstone. So throughout his poetry and his essays, you see him sort of pulling out, teasing out these particular sort of elements of Tantra as he interprets them, incorporating them into his sort of syncretic vision the same way that Yeats sort of did it, only without the sort of theosophical stuff that Yeats then threw into the mix. And it ultimately leads to the same place, this sense that, Alexis Sanderson has pointed out, that ultimately what Tantra leads to is a shift from the appetitive to the aesthetic mode of awareness. That ultimately the universe is regarded as play, as in the Jnanagarbha Stotra. There's one passage where the yogi addresses the absolute and says, your playful desire is the cause of the diversity between perceiver, perceiving, perception, and perceptible. When your playful desire is over, that diversity disappears somewhere. At one point, Paz refers to all the universe being just obliterated with a blink, which is clearly a reference to Shiva closing his eyes. And then, and this sense of ritual and this sense of play, and that the universe is itself a kind of poem, a poetic text, and that poetry is an incarnation. As Paz says, art is the opposite of dissipation in the physical and spiritual sense of the word. It is concentration, desire that seeks incarnation, which in some ways is a formula for the genesis of the cosmos in some sort of tantric cosmologies. When he actually left India in 1968, the last thing he wrote as a sort of valediction is the poem you've got in front of you there. Can I borrow yours for a second?
Sure.
Sunday at the Island of Elephanta, and you can read the whole thing. First, you know, it's two parts, an imprecation and an invocation. The imprecation just being how him venting his spleen at all the people who leave their garbage there, and those who have vandalized, the sculptures. But notice also where the kind of ambivalence, the tension in his own dialogue with Indic tradition and with Tantra that he seeks to cultivate as he leaves in the invocation. Shiva and Parvati, we worship you not as gods, but as images of the divinity of man. You are what man makes and is not, what man will be when he has served the sentence of hard labor. Shiva, your forearms are four rivers, four jets of water. Your whole being is a fountain where the lovely Parvati bathes, where she rocks like a graceful boat. The sea beats beneath the sun. It is the great lips of Shiva laughing. The sea is ablaze. It is the step of Parvati on the waters. Shiva and Parvati, the woman who is my wife and I, ask you for nothing, nothing that comes from the other world. Only the light on the sea, the barefoot light on the sleeping land and sea. And there you have the manifested universe as an object of aesthetic appreciation. At the same time, this tremendous pull toward the primal unity, and at the same time, a kind of repulsion, a kind of rejection of it. No, I am too in love with the multiplicity of life and the beauty of that sort of dance to want to transcend it, you know. So I will try to somehow sustain that tension, and that's what he does through a good deal of his work. So there you have it. So open to questions, comments, suggestions, anything like that.
Yes, I assume he was raised Catholic. What was his relationship to Catholicism?
It's actually it's a good question. He very much appreciated anything that was Spanish Baroque, including the classic sort of Spanish mystics of the 15th century, which, you know, if you, I mean, obviously the John of the Cross is sort of the gold standard for him in terms of a Western expression of erotic, you know, sort of imagery involving mystical aspiration. He also wrote a actually very well received book on Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, who was a Mexican nun who wrote in a very similar vein. He lamented what he called Spanish, and by Spanish he meant the same Catholicism that then spread to Latin America, Spanish Catholicism's militarism, as he saw it, that it was too imbued with the spirit of the Crusades. But he also saw a brilliant, coherent mysticism in it that did not reject the body, that had an interesting form of that body and non-body dialectic going on. I think he had far less use for Protestantism, actually. Though he tries to sort of sustain a kind of, you know, bird's eye view of the whole enterprise. So I think while it was not his tradition, so to speak, ultimately, it was a tradition that he venerated. Does that make sense? At least that aspect of the Catholic tradition. Mm. Yeah. Yeah?
I have a question regarding the... you read the poems from the book A Tale of Two Gardens. You referred to Vrindavan?
Yeah.
And then was it like...
That's one poem within the book.
And this is written in Vrindavan, or is it a description of Vrindavan?
It's basically just inspired by a visit. So So several of the poems are named after places he visited and had experiences of one kind or another that sort of elicited poems. So he sort of gives them titles that he sort of flags as visits. There's quite a sort of geography, not just of India, because actually when he was ambassador to India, he also was ambassador. They sort of folded into that mission Afghanistan. And I think perhaps even Pakistan, which was very interesting. And then so some of his stuff actually involves visits to, you know, places like Herat and stuff like that. And one of the things that he enjoys writing about is this, what was the precise relation between Sufism and some of the particular forms of Tantra and other forms of you know, traditions in northern India, especially, obviously. So he's fascinated by that piece.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. That was incredibly insightful. And I'm going to ask quite a boring question, I guess. But I'm interested in how his thought was received in India. I mean, seeing he was an ambassador and politically active and stuff, he has a lot to say about the Indian tradition.
That's a really good question, because my sense of it is... one would imagine some of his pronouncements on Indian history, there would at best be ambivalence there. But he's actually very, very admired, mainly for his poetry and for the reverence that he has for some of those traditions. So I think the way it gets spun in India, they actually had a big sort of observance on the 10th anniversary of his death, too. You know, I mean, it was... I think the way they choose to look at him is as a Westerner who really sought to immerse himself, not just in an academic sense, but in that experiential sense, who had a love affair, so to speak, with India, who really did appreciate those traditions. And you could say, well, if he says that they're moribund, if he says that... That at one point he actually says, you know, Indian history ended at the point that historians of India call the Indian Middle Ages. He actually says that at one point. That they can say that he only says those things because he is so appreciative and so reverent, you know, in regard to those traditions. And he wants to see them brought back to life. He wants to see them revived. I don't think they would agree that I don't think that many people would necessarily agree that sort of the Hindu tradition, so to speak, of India needs an interlocutor in Buddhism and not Islam or something else in order for that revival to take place. I mean, there's quite a lot of dialogue and debate happening very much, obviously, within those traditions. But whereas he would say it becomes mannered, you know, and becomes sort of attenuated, you know, you could certainly see a great deal of life there. I'm surprised that I found nowhere in his writings any reference to what some have referred to as the kind of stultifying effect of the sort of attempt to take some of the most palatable to Western minds, arguably, elements of Indic traditions and present them, or, you know, what some scholars have called the Vedanticization of Hinduism, so to speak, there's a kind of plain vanilla quality to what some would call Sanatana Dharma, you know, and that might be what he could point to as what has vitiated the tradition, that there's just been too much suppression of what they were afraid would be regarded as scandalous or something. He doesn't go in that direction, which is very interesting to me. Other people have, but...
Yeah. And with regard to language, like, did he write in English? Did he attempt to write in indigenous language?
He did study Sanskrit, but he did not, to my knowledge, attempt to write in it. He was fluent in a number of languages. He was a pretty formidable polymath, but he wrote almost exclusively in Spanish. So
his assessment of India as a sort of stagnant civilization, that's post the medieval period, then?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, he basically dates it to what he says 8 centuries, but, you know, he would basically say more or less when the dialogue between Buddhism and Hinduism, again, for lack of a better term, effectively ended, when Buddhism essentially sort of really retreated from the Indian subcontinent in certain ways. He felt Islam. And Islam came in. He said there was no dialogue possible with Islam, which is interesting, because in another place he actually argues that the Indic traditions and the Abrahamic traditions are actually part of one system, and what they can't dialogue with is the traditions as they've manifested in China and Japan, which strikes me as really counterintuitive. I think what it is he says the simplicity and directness, the kind of puritanical strength. Borrow a term there, not so much from him as from Paul Tillich, to say that the puritanical quality of Islam, particularly in its early phases, that it was a kind of a reform kind of movement at the beginning. Its very simplicity and directness, and its insistence on the alterity of the divine, made it impossible for that dialogue to happen. Whereas the Hindu traditions sort of cohabitated very comfortably with very complex notions of divinity and shifting notions.
Puritan in the original meaning of the word, then?
Yes, as in trying to sort of purify monotheism. You know,
that's interesting, though. So it's almost like Islam is too much other for there to be that dialectic.
Yeah.
So he's kind of then sort of the implication would be that there needs to be some sense of unity to begin with for there to be this, polarity,
right,
from which there can be a productive, movement or dynamism.
Right, exactly. It's like, what are you going to locate within a system for that dynamism to happen? And then, and yet at the same time, then he has he postulates these situations where they're simply different systems, and so therefore the dynamic tension can't happen.
Yeah.
So nothing constructive can happen. And I guess what he's really saying is their ontologies are just kind of incompatible, ultimately. And that I think also is partly what his fascination with Sufism is, because he sees it as somehow obviously engaging in much more of a dialogue with the Indic traditions on the one side and more sort of the more legalistic and the more Sharia-driven kind of Islam on the other.
Then in the Sufi poets.
Yes, yes, he was.
Which Sufi poets?
Hmm?
Which Sufi poets?
Let's see.
Rumi.
What's that? Actually, he loved the ones that were on the borders. I mean, actually, he doesn't talk much about Rumi. He talks Hafiz. And he actually sort of folds Tukaram in there.
Jaisi, maybe?
Hmm?
Jaisi?
Doesn't mention.
Yes.
No. And let's see. Who else does he mention? I know I'm missing one.
Bulesha, Shahsan.
Nope.
Sultan Bahu.
Oh, he does mention Kabir.
Kabir.
He was interested in Kabir, who is, of course, extremely liminal in that regard.
And does he have his own sort of purohit? Does he have a kind of guru figure that he's being guided by in his interpretation?
I think he had several. Mostly scholarly. I think he actually tells a fascinating story about visiting a spiritual director at her ashram. With Raja Rao, and I think he was probably pretty fortunate to encounter a lot of cultural figures of high standing who were also either scholars of or scholars and to some degree practitioners of some of these traditions, who were willing to sort of introduce him to things. That's the sense that I get. But there was no sort of Virgil to his Dante, Purohit to his Yeats, if there was, he doesn't mention one,
I wanted to ask how this kind of confrontation with the tantric actually affected his own concept, self-concept as a poet. I mean, does he regard himself and his poetry and the works as tantric works now, or is he actually questioning the very distinction between poetry and tantrism? Are the two kind of the same process, in that it comes from your own experience. It comes from ontology.
Yeah.
It can't proceed from anywhere other than that. It cannot be a purely idealistic process.
That's actually, I wish I could give you a really clear answer to that question, but he never actually comes out and states what he's after there. He does have certain, like, poetic kind of manifestos at times, but they generally predate his real immersion, and they're more of like from his surrealist period, which was, of course, you know, if you were surrealist, you had to have a manifesto. And what my sense is that he would never go as far as to make a religion of poetry, in that sense. But he does, I believe, and this is where I think I would have to pursue more how he deals in sort of theology of language, theologies of the word. I think that he sees himself as, I think ultimately he's an aesthete in a way, in that he wants the glimpses but doesn't want to give up the individual self getting the glimpses. And so his and so that filters into his understanding of poetry as being
quite tantric in itself.
Because
you're still retaining the tension.
Well, I mean, in his vision of Tantra, well, see, that's the thing. He's again, when he talks about Tantra, ultimately he does talk about transcendence and dissolution and overcoming all the oppositions under the sign of the body, but then beyond using the body to then get beyond all the opposite, you know, those binary oppositions. That's sort of the paradox of it. I think it's the classic tension that you see when people who are very much wedded, Western or otherwise, to sort of individuated consciousness as the essence of subjectivity and artistic endeavor. So if he sees poetry as a precipitate of an individuated consciousness, then he can't. I think to some degree he's always going to, just as he does in Sunday at the Island of Elefante, he's always going to want to stop short of equating or, you know, saying I write tantric poetry or that poetry can serve the same function spiritually as tantric ritual or whatever. Does that start to answer your question a little bit? Or am I not quite on it?
The kind of poetry that you were reading in some ways didn't seem to be too distinct from the kind of metaphors that you might find within tantric works themselves. Mm-hmm. The fact that he appears to kind of use the kind of methods of tantra, and so you start to think, well, where is the distinction? At what point does he cease
I guess
an objective poet.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's always tricky to try to determine, because he never comes out and calls himself a tantric poet. No, at any point does he ever do that. But it's always difficult to ascertain, partly because these matters are so interior, you know, that he's clearly appropriating the discursive strategies and the images. To what extent can we leap from there to incorporating conviction and practice? He seems to suggest, he does say his knowledge is rudimentary, but he also says it's experiential. Well, what does that mean? To what extent did he actually buy in to one or another of these sort of tantric cosmologies? You know what I mean? It's a curious question.
He was calling the poems after the places in which, you know, he was inspired, in which, so it does sort of root it in experience very much.
Yes, so yeah. He clearly saw it as a pilgrimage and made pilgrimages within this pilgrimage.
Yeah.
And he clearly wanted to get, insofar as was possible, and he seems not to have thought it was entirely possible, sort of the T.S. Eliot argument about what he called deracination. He says, because Eliot contemplated converting to Buddhism at one point.
Yeah.
And he later said, I didn't do it because it would have involved shattering, basically, and remaking all the categories through which I understand the world. And it would have been too hard to do. And I, you know, and I found what I needed in the tradition that I chose. And
you revisit it, don't you, and see it differently once you've visited another tradition.
Yes, exactly. Very, very much so in the case of Eliot, absolutely. And he never let go of what he brought back from his studies in Sanskrit and Indic traditions. But and I think in some ways it's probably the same. There's an essay at the end of In Light of India in which I think is revealing on this point, because he talks about the notion of freedom and that he's not willing to let go of a notion of freedom or a pursuit of liberation that, for his mind, does not involve politics as well, that does not also involve civic engagement, that does not involve a kind of a search for a better communal order. And I think on some level he regards Tantra and some of these other Indic traditions as too much about liberating the individual without sufficient engagement in basically social justice one way or another. And I think that's also sort of underlies part of his probable sort of appropriation of some elements, but refusal to commit, so to speak, personally, to being a tantric poet, or say that poetry can or even should accomplish the same thing, because he's also trying to achieve a kind of cultural transformation or kind
and
of
so he
collective.
Believes that poetry can.
Oh, he absolutely believes. He absolutely believes poetry can do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, if things are being appropriated, then sort of substantively, what do you see it? That he's appropriating, is it an ontology, a metaphysics,
I think,
cosmology?
Yeah, I think he toys with that, with what he sees as tantric notions of sort of the ontological ground, you know, and the subject. I think he likes the metaphysics. I think that mainly. Yeah, I would say mainly ontologically, he likes, and he incorporates into his poetry the notion, this tantric notion, that essentially any moment, any experience, and most importantly and most decisively, because it is, as he puts it, a homologue of Shiva and Shakti, the sexual union, can be a window through which you can glimpse reality, or can be a, if you can trace it back to its ontological root, you know, it's the same thing as tracing it through the body, so to speak, you can access, at least temporarily, a kind of reality, a kind of bliss that undergirds everything. But remember, he calls it our ration, or our share of paradise. There's a sense that you don't get. He doesn't say that you can. I'm not sure what he believed. He doesn't say that you can, but he certainly says he doesn't want to be a Jivan Mukta. Let me put it that way. You know, I think he does. What it does is it allows him to. It sacralizes phenomenal experience for him. That's what most appeals to him about Tantra, that he can instead, it's a way, again, he wants some intimation of truth, but he doesn't want to arrive at it by negation. As much as he appreciates Buddhism, and as much as he says at one point, I think more or less accurately, in the Mahayana tradition, ultimately negation leads to a negation of negation. But he wants affirmation. He wants extrovertive mysticism, so to speak, to use that term. There's something Whitman-esque in how he wants to see the world. So if every experience traced to its root can be a kind of avenue or opening on an experience of the bliss of supreme reality. Even if you only get a glimpse of it, well, that's an extraordinary thing. But like Yeats, you're in that same dilemma where if he believes that by transcending or resolving binary oppositions, you end up either with a plenitude of being that's static, even if it's blissful, or emptiness or whatever, and therefore you then don't create, you know, the energy is gone, the vivifying energies are gone, then he's not willing to buy wholly into the program. Does that help?
Yeah, poetry is highly disciplined.
Yes.
And requires craft.
Yes.
But it seems to me there's a tension between the control, like going back to the poem that you opened with, and a sort of concept of surrender.
Yes.
And the bliss and the transcendence through surrender, which you also get in the sort of, you know, Baroque paintings of ascension and so forth, that sort of lifting out and elevation through surrender.
Right, yeah. yeah, I would agree with that.
But then
completely.
The control.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't want to let
Western
exactly again
imposing order and
yeah, and it's interesting because he explicitly deals with that in his poetry. At one point, he says when he started writing Sunstone, he said it just came to him. It was almost like automatic writing.
Yeah.
But then he had to give it the shape ultimately that he wanted to give it. So there, even in the writing of the poetry, in a true sort of surrealist sense, you know, but also in I think this sense of waiting on divine inspiration one way or another, it comes forth, but you have to hammer it into shape, and that tension is there too. And the you hammering it into shape has to be that individuated person. He doesn't. You know there's always that resistance, that resistance to the notion that the individual is not the true subject. That's really what it boils down to. That's what Yeats resisted, I think, on some level. That's what Paz resists, even if he says, "Okay, that's true. Maybe that's true. Maybe I can accept this ontologically." You know, right? I'm still not going to live that way. And I think that's what's right there in the poem. It says, "It's okay. You're right." But I'm going to pretend you're not, because I'm enjoying myself too much. You know, it's something along those lines. I sort of get that. But yeah,
Just a general question about your research. The sort of tendencies. Do you see it as a kind of, you know, in tracing these tantric strains and these various? Do you think you're touching upon a kind of a sort of transmission of tantric traditions to the West in almost? I mean, obviously not in their complete sort of, you know, unadulterated forms, but I mean, there are substantial kind of concepts that are being transmitted and are being, I mean, having some influence.
I think there has been. I actually would like to sort of pursue that a bit, particularly in poetry, that not just Hindu, but also Buddhist in the sense. I mean, there are serious tantric Buddhist. Everybody looks at, for instance, Gary Snyder and says, oh, yeah, he's a Zen poet. Well, that begs two questions. One is how much tantric stuff is lurking in Zen? And then it also begs a question of, well, what are all these Tibetan goddesses doing in his poetry? These, you know, the certain tantric elements. So you've got some of it coming in on the Buddhist side. And certainly some of the other, you know, beat guys, you know, Ginsberg, obviously. And then you've got Yeats, you know, and people sort of following it there with Yeats, and then you've got Paz, and I think it's there. I think most, you know, but you can't really look for it until after about 1920, you know, when, the tantric text series was really well underway, and a lot of this stuff was sort of trickling through. But I think it's there. I do think it's there.
But even there's more than that, because then there's the actual dialogue back, because there was Indian writers who were then influenced by romanticism, Western romanticism, fed it back into their own culture. And you're like, well, what are we talking about? Are we talking about Western ideas?
Exactly. And it becomes this weird sort of, and it's always, it's the vector never goes one way, right? And then there, and it's always more complex than you think. But then sifting through that is so much fun, and just sort of being able to isolate out certain movements is really fascinating. I think for me, in terms of that sort of tantric stuff trickling over the West, I think Paz is really the sort of the gold standard. He's the guy that's really, you know, done the most consciously to do it. There are some contemporary French poets that are doing it too. And it's interesting because I actually wrote an article, it's not a scholarly article, for a friend's online journal called Wave Composition, in which I talk about the abstract tantric art from Rajasthan that made a splash in shows in the States last year, and relate it, because it superficially it bears just shocking resemblances to a good deal of Western 20th century art. And so there was all this sort of buzz. Well, what does this mean? Of course, what does it mean? Well, what it means is they look alike, because they're encoding utterly different sensibilities. And so what I do in that article is also look at the differences. And so I look at Mark Rothko and measure him in some ways, a fundamentally tragic sensibility against a sensibility that, as Yeats, I think, rightly said, knows nothing of tragedy, because in a tantric worldview, tragedy doesn't exist in an absolute sense. Right, it's all the play of the divine, and so tragedy in that sense is sort of a precipitate of Western culture, and here you have sort of artistic languages that are shockingly similar, but at the service of diametrically opposed worldviews. So you have to be so careful when you're looking for those links. You know, the whole correlation isn't causation thing you have to be really careful with.
Did Paz acknowledge Buddhist tantric texts as sort of a...
Yes, he did.
He was aware that they had both sort of early, quite disgusting ones. And
yeah, he actually refers specifically to a Buddhist tantric text that calls for, in one ritual, the murder of a man, and the man has to be a good man. And I forget which tantra it was, but he was absolutely aware of it. So he didn't have a sort of abstracted and whitewashed notion of tantric Buddhism. Yeah. So yeah, it's really, really, really fascinating. And then as I said, he still goes. He says, but if you're really willing to buy completely into the tantric program, at a certain point, the very category criminal ceases to have meaning. You're really going... He actually appropriates, you know, Nietzsche and says, you know, these are people who are very absolutely serious about going beyond good and evil. You know?
That's present in seed form in the... isn't the Chandogya and Kshatriya Upanishads?
Yeah.
So, you know, if you know Brahman, you kill a fetus or Brahmin.
Yeah.
You won't be harmed.
It all becomes, where are you performing this action from?
Yes.
Inwardly, as opposed to the action itself, right? So, it's fascinating.
Dangerous stuff.
Yeah. Danger. Danger.
Cool.
Thanks for coming, guys.